I intend to shoot a projectile to the moon.
It's one small step for man.
The future was supposed to be astonishing.
By 2013, I literally envisioned that I would be retiring on the moon.
Sure, not everything we were promised by science fiction is here.
Where is my flying car? It's just something that's been around a long time.
But if you look closer, you can see that the world we live in today, a lot of it was dreamed up in the science fiction of the last century.
A successful science fiction story or novel or film allows its readers to become comfortable with the future. It softens the edge of change.
Today in Studio 360, last year's science fiction is just this year's news. I'm Kurt Anderson. That's all ahead this hour in Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI. The countdown begins.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today in the show, the future, by which I mean the present, which was the future not so long ago. I think you know this image. It's iconic. The moon is a big white face smiling in a black sky. It's really an actor in makeup with craters on his face. Suddenly, a bullet-sized rocket lands smack into his left eye, making him wince. It's one of the earliest films, Le Voyage dans la Lune, or A Trip to the Moon, based on a Jules Verne story. But this is just funny old stuff. It's got nothing to do with actual space travel, right? Or maybe it does. Claire Evans is the editor who relaunched the science magazine Omni, and she thinks Jules Verne was onto something.
He just extrapolated from the technology around him. So in From the Earth to the Moon, people go to space in a giant cannon, a massive sort of shotgun barrel shoots people into space. That's not what happened in the real world, but that essential gesture is correct.
That gesture, blasting tubes full of people into space, it's not really so different to imagine a giant cannon as it is to imagine the Saturn rockets that carried Apollo astronauts.
A successful science fiction story or novel or film allows its readers to become comfortable with the future, with radical new technologies and ideas before they become commonplace. It softens the edge of change.
Real-life science and technology are full of ideas cribbed from and inspired by the imaginations of fiction writers, artists, and filmmakers. Like, did you know that H.G. Wells, the time machine guy, imagined the first atomic bomb?
The gaunt face hardened to grimness, and with both hands, the bomb thrower lifted the big atomic bomb from the box and steadied it against the side. It was a black sphere, 2 feet in diameter. Very quickly, he bent forward, bit the stud, and hoisted the bomb over the side. The bomb flashed blinding scarlet in midair and fell, a descending column of blaze, eddying spirally in the midst of a whirlwind. When he could look down again, it was like looking down upon the crater of a small volcano.
More like a radioactive hand grenade, but this was 1913 in a story called The World Set Free, 30 years before the Manhattan Project. And another amazing example, the first geostationary satellite was described in a British technical paper from 1945. The author was Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer. Clarke had a degree in mathematics, and in fact, the orbit of communications and weather satellites today is called the Clarke orbit in his honor. But Clarke is better known for his fiction, especially his collaboration with Stanley Kubrick on 2001 A Space Odyssey, still one of the best movies about life in space.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
There is an Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination at UC San Diego. David Brin is the astrophysicist and novelist who helped create it.
There was a period during the space race when suddenly science fiction authors were very much in vogue, when they were on the platforms next to Walter Cronkite and talking about the future of civilization and where we were going to go next.
With you followed space longer than almost anybody, except maybe the first rocketeers.
Here is Arthur Clarke with Walter Cronkite on TV in 1969.
What do you think the significance of Apollo 10 is?
Well, you know, it's as if we're at Kitty Hawk now in 1900 and, say, about November 1903, and the Wrights are just playing around with their airplane, and we're trying to anticipate what importance this is going to be, and accept that this is more important, probably, than the conquest of the air. So it depends on the time scale you take. In the long run, the conquest of space is going to be much more important than the conquest of the air, because after all, the airplane only took us to places we've already been to. But what's happening now, we're going to go to new worlds.
But as society became more skeptical, so did science fiction. In the 1980s, the hot genre was cyberpunk, which imagined, before the web existed, seductive digital fantasy worlds and virtual relationships.
Cyberpunk was the first science fiction movement to really understand that science and technology weren't separate from us. Those stories and novels are about technology that is with us, that is under our skins, that is in our minds.
Clara Evans loved the stuff as a teenager, and so did the generation that created the internet as we know it.
A year here and he still dreamed of cyberspace, hope fading nightly, all the speed he took.
Here's William Gibson reading from his 1984 novel Neuromancer. When he coined the term cyberspace, he imagined it as being totally addictive, so much more interesting than real life, almost painful to disconnect from. Sound familiar?
But the dreams came on in the Japanese night like live wire voodoo. And he'd cry for it, cry in his sleep and wake alone in the dark, curled in his capsule in some coffin hotel, his hands clawed into the bed slab, temper foam bunched between his fingers, trying to reach the console that wasn't there.
A good science fiction story, to quote the writer Frederick Pohl, should be able to predict not the automobile, but the traffic jam.
What is technology doing to us as a culture? How is it changing our children? You know, when you see a 2-year-old reach for an iPad and intuitively understand the interface, what does that mean about the future generation? Science fiction looks at that 2-year-old with an iPad and says, okay, what is that kid, when that kid is 50 years old, what does the world look like? What has changed?
And it doesn't have to look scary. David Brin says we have to keep writing and reading science fiction about the distant future with better possibilities, because it's pretty hard to get people to build something that nobody has ever imagined.
There are opportunities out there. And if we're a bold civilization, if we regain some of the boldness of the 60s, while chastened by some of the warnings that came after that, then we'll be able to reach out for the things our grandchildren need. Asteroidal resources, for example, that could make us so rich that we could turn the Earth into a park. That sounds utopian. And yet so were so many of the things we take for granted about our own civilization.
David Brin is the author of the Uplift trilogy and other books. Clara Evans is the editor of Omni. And I'm Kurt Anderson. In Studio 360 today, we're looking at artists of all kinds who imagined the future in which we're living right now. If you talk to scientists and technologists about how they got inspired, there's a subject that comes up again and again. Whether it's an astronomer you're talking to, a computer scientist, biologist, rocket engineer, you can't avoid the subject even if you wanted to.
Space, the final frontier.
So we asked Julia Wetherell to go there, boldly.
For 2 years, the Juno probe has been hurtling through space on its way to Jupiter at a mind-boggling 15 miles a second. Almost warp speed, right?
To get from here to the nearest star at Juno's speed would take about 30,000 years.
Or maybe not.
30,000 years ago, we humans were inventing the bow and arrow, slapping some paint on some walls in caves in France, and domesticating this vicious animal that people now carry around in little bags on the Upper West Side called dogs.
That's K.E. Savick Ford, an astrophysicist at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. even if we're a long way off from building a warp drive, Savick will be the first to tell you how important Star Trek is to people who study outer space. Because way before she got a PhD and started observing supermassive black holes for a living, she was a girl who named herself after a Vulcan.
Well, Mr. Savick, are you going to stay with the sinking ship?
Permission to speak candidly, sir.
Kirstie Alley played Savick in The Wrath of Khan.
I don't believe this was a fair test of my command abilities. There was no way to win.
I love the character Savick because she was a Vulcan, and she was rational, and she was calm, and she was smart, and she was a scientist.
Trouble with the nebula, sir, is all that static discharge and gas clouds our tactical display. Visual won't function, and shields will be useless.
And I went away to camp when I was 12, and I realized that I had the opportunity to say who I was. And so when I started to introduce myself to people, I said, hi, I'm Savick.
Star Trek went on the air in the late 1960s. Earthlings already had gone into orbit, and we were getting ready to actually land somewhere, on the moon.
Space, the final frontier.
So a generation of scientists got all fired up by the fantasy and the reality of space travel at the same time.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission.
And remember what the first space shuttle was called in the 1970s?
America's first space shuttle, the Enterprise. They lifted off from a strip in the Mojave Desert, climbing into the morning air to make a bit of history today.
By 2013, let me phrase it this way. I literally envisioned that I would be retiring on the moon.
Candy Torres is a former software engineer for the International Space Station in Houston, which was as close as she could get to working for Starfleet.
For the International Space Station, the crew uses terms like science officer.
This is Commander Spock, science officer.
Like Savick, Torres has her Star Trek namesake, the character B'Elanna Torres, who's the chief engineer on Star Trek Voyager.
I could modify a series of anodyne relays.
She's half human and half Klingon. And in my mind, that human half, she has to be Puerto Rican.
They could act as a sort of regulator to make the warp plasma compatible with the robot's energy matrix.
I started watching Star Trek right from the very beginning in 1966. Sonia Sotomayor said television showed us worlds and possibilities beyond where we lived. And we're both Puerto Rican. She lived in South Bronx. I lived in North Bronx. We're almost the same age. Technology and the future were positive. The world would be better.
What's it like out there in the galaxy?
We're on 1,000 planets and spreading out. We cross fantastic distances, and everything's alive, Cochrane. Life everywhere. We estimate there are millions of planets with intelligent life.
It's the optimism of the show that makes Star Trek so important to scientists. Take this basic tenet of the Star Trek universe. In the 23rd century, any disease can be diagnosed in seconds with a single scan of a medical tricorder.
She's a mute, Jim. No vocal cords.
Today, there's a company offering $10 million to the people who can figure out how to make the tricorder a reality in our century. And some of the people working on this stuff have gotten close. If this sounds crazy, remember, we all walk around with a little piece of Star Trek in our pockets every day.
Yeah, my name is Martin Cooper. I'm in the wireless business.
Which is one way of saying he invented the cell phone.
We actually knew that the communicator of Star Trek was possible from the moment that we saw it.
It just took a few years. In 1973, Cooper and his team at Motorola built the first wireless phone.
Think about it. The communicator could only talk to other people who were members of the Enterprise crew.
Kirk Enterprise.
Scott here, sir.
We're beaming up. Notify transporter room.
If I really wanted to be imaginative, which I am, by the way, they should have been able to talk to anybody in the universe, don't you think?
So you've got your communicator. But 45 years after the first moon landing, it seems like we're only getting farther away from building a real starship.
President Obama intends to switch to commercial contracts to launch astronauts into space. That means NASA would be out of the business of doing that. For Americans aged 50...
With no manned spaceflight program in the U.S. anymore, how are we ever going to get beamed up anywhere?
People who have degrees in astrophysics can go off and make a gajillion dollars on Wall Street because it's the same analytical and quantitative tools that we use to analyze what's going on around a black hole also apply to analyzing stocks and bond prices.
The problem with pushing the frontier of science is that it's not all rational. You need to listen to conflicting impulses to come up with creative solutions, not just Vulcan logic. It's also not about who's the biggest hero or the best fighter pilot. It's about how people are better when they work together. That's the moral of Star Trek.
There's Spock as that rationalist who's going to say, we have to do it this way, Captain, and Bones the pessimist saying, we can't do anything, Captain, and, you know, Kirk going out there and saying, we are going to go out there and we are going to do it and we're going to do awesome.
Well, we're doing everything as possible. Bones, I want the impossible checked out, too.
If you are purely rational, you would never start a problem that is going to take you months to solve. People who view science as strictly a rational enterprise don't know what science is really like.
Instruments register only those things they're designed to register. Space still contains infinite unknowns.
Remember, the Enterprise launches in the 23rd century. We've got time. We'll get there. For Studio 360, I'm Julia Wetherill.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Just ahead this hour, the real deal with space.
You know, on Star Trek, they were never weightless, and everyone was always on the same sleep shift. They have to simplify things to fit it into a half hour. But in the reality of things, when you're actually living in weightlessness, with the practicalities, come the real insights.
Astronaut Chris Hadfield, the International Space Station superstar. That's in a minute in Studio 360. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on.
This is a recent cover of David Bowie's 45-year-old song, Space Oddity. And it got something like 20 million views on YouTube. Not because of Chris Hadfield's voice, which isn't bad at all for an astronaut, but because Commander Hadfield was singing the song in space aboard the International Space Station.
Love be with you.
It is a blending of science fiction and science fact. It's a blending of science and art. And that, I think, is what really got everybody's attention.
This is ground control to Major Tom.
Social media has changed life in space. There are videos to shoot, tweets to write. Hadfield has to answer everybody's questions from space, like the classic, how do you go to the bathroom?
When you're watching any movie, hardly ever do the actors in a TV show or a movie go to the bathroom or sleep. You know, on Star Trek, they were never weightless, and everyone was always on the same sleep shift, and, you know, they have to simplify things to fit it into a half hour. But in the reality of things, when you're actually living in weightlessness, you know, the practicalities of it, but with the practicalities come the real insights. You know, how do fluids behave? How does fire behave? When I lived on the space station for almost half a year, I really tried to resolve to show people and to try and answer those questions.
Techmi from B-Town, Ontario asked, is it challenging to brush your teeth in space without getting toothpaste up your nose from weightlessness? Well, let's talk about how to brush your teeth in space.
I had a long phone call back and forth with I guess I can call him Bill Shatner now, with Bill Shatner. So we had a long conversation, and it was really interesting. He wasn't interested in talking about things that happened 40 years ago on TV. He was interested in what's going on, what's happening on station, where are we headed next, what, you know, what's the purpose of it, what's the actual experience like. And then I've been in contact with him several times since. So that was a real treat to get to know someone who had been a childhood hero for me.
And he hasn't totally given up on the Star Trek dream. Even now, he's thinking about starship fuel, dilithium crystals.
What that is inherently is an unlimited, non-polluting energy source That would, I would love for us, for our cleverest scientists and boffins to get to the point where we figure out how to truly unleash the power that exists in every single atom that was put there through the incredible processes in an exploding star somewhere that made all of our complex elements. If we could somehow controllably release that in a lot of science fiction, there's just the assumption all of the things that come from a power source like that are available, and it would change so many things.
Here am I, floating in my tin can, a last glimpse of the world. Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing left to do.
That was the Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. I'm Kurt Anderson. In today's hour of Studio 360, we're looking at how science fiction inspires real scientists and the world they shape. In the Oscar-winning movie Her, a lonely guy, played by Joaquin Phoenix, falls in love with his computer's new operating system.
Actually, the woman that I've been seeing, Samantha, I didn't tell you, but she's an OS.
You're dating an OS? What is that like?
It's great, actually. Yeah. I feel really close to her. Like, when I talk to her, I feel like she's with me.
It is not played as a gag. This is a real romance. Samantha is an artificial intelligence. She's conscious, able to tell jokes, feel things, and evolve. According to some experts in artificial intelligence, this is not so far off. The true believers believe that computers will be self-aware in the next couple of decades and that AI will change everything. This idea is known as the singularity. The concept and word come from a 1993 paper written by a computer scientist and science fiction writer named Werner Vinge. His paper was meant as something of a warning shot, but Vinge says whatever happens will be way beyond anything that fiction or our little biological brains can imagine.
The analogy I use is if you had a magical way to talk to Mark Twain, you could explain the interview we're doing now. If you had a way of talking to a goldfish, there's no way you could make the goldfish understand what this interview is.
Right. So it is, in a way, it's what you're suggesting will happen is only reachable in a speculative, imaginative way, i.e. perfect for science fiction writers.
Yes, although also I like to say that we science fiction writers are the first occupational group who has been impacted by the singularity, whether or not it really happens, because if you write science fiction that's about things that are, you figure, you know, can really happen – then if you also think that the singularity is going to happen, you can't very well write realistically about events more than 30 or 40 years
right.
in the future.
Right. Sometime in the middle of this century, Vinge and the singularitarians think, we'll be able to merge our brains with these super smart computers. Then, the singularity optimists say, progress will jump to warp speed. We'll be curing diseases and solving all sorts of vexing problems in energy and the environment and everywhere else. And then, when our bodies fail, we can upload our minds and sort of live forever.
In some ways, I have a lot of friends who are most comfortable with that. The way they, as one of my friends put it, I do not regard this as a singularity if I'm riding it. In other words, if it's my intellectual ability that is being improved by, you know, adding on these auxiliary mental powers. So my friend says to me, this will not be a singularity. It will be one smooth run to increased ability, and it won't be unintelligible or unknowable to me, to the future me. Of course, to the people who don't choose to participate, things will get seriously unintelligible.
So as long as we join them, we'll be fine.
join the more, if a slightly more human-centric terminology would be, we use them simply as amplifications of our own intelligence, of our native intelligence.
Or the other side of that, and I think you've said this, is that these super intelligent computers won't wipe us out because they think we might be useful to turn them back on in case of a problem.
Right. That, I think, is an underappreciated value of humanity, but I hope it's appreciated by the right people at the right time.
But there are lots of smart, successful, rich people in Silicon Valley who believe in the coming singularity and believe that it'll be the best thing that's ever happened to us. You can spend $12,000 for a week at Singularity University, where gurus like Ray Kurzweil, now Google's director of engineering, can help you prepare for your super upgrade in the astonishing near future. Werner Vinge does not share that absolute optimism.
In a way, I regard the situation that we're facing here as scary because it is sort of the radical endpoint of optimism. It's what happens if you sit down and think seriously about wanting the things that humans and the human condition has always cried out for the most over millennia. That is a defense against death and you know being able to overcome the barriers that life presents to us. If you think seriously about overcoming some of those barriers and what that would mean, that actually is scary. And I don't think people have actually ever had to think seriously about those things in the past. And in this era, I think it is actually on the table.
Which is to say, sort of perfection and something like heaven and utopia are terrifying.
Yeah, if you really mean it.
And as I read again the books by the totally optimistic singularity people, there is a kind of religious quality to their optimism that, you know, you'll get immortality in the form of your mind being uploaded and that all earthly problems will be solved by nanotechnology and AI. That there is a kind of religious conviction to this.
I think part of that is not surprising from the fact that that the whole idea is talking about things that are on a scale that previously was associated with religion. I've been confronted with this singularity as the rapture of the geeks argument,
yes.
which is a really cool way of, you know, collapsing the whole thing.
So I guess my takeaway, though, is that while you recognize all of the dark and dystopian possibilities, you are more optimistic than you are pessimistic.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Well, good. I'll take it from you then. You know more than I do, so I'll try to let that be a contact optimism.
Good.
Werner Vinge, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Kurt.
You can learn more about our computer overlords at studio360.org. Coming up, we were promised flying cars. So far, we got Twitter. But don't give up hope. Flying cars are just around the corner, I swear.
Do you feel like you're being lifted up from below? It's really, truly a flying carpet sensation.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI.
I'll see you later, I hope.
Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
In the year 2525.
In today's show, we've been looking at writers, artists, and filmmakers who inspired us to dream big and think about how incredible the future can be. But there is a whole other sci-fi thread that goes in the opposite direction, warning us that the future could be a nightmare.
In a city of 106 million people.
The Terminator is out there.
The Matrix is everywhere.
It can't be reasoned with.
What number you all wear? What's it mean?
Oh, Fahrenheit 451. There's a temperature at which book paper catches fire and starts to burn.
And then I watched them liquefy the dead so they could be fed intravenously to the living.
Listen to me very carefully.
You gotta tell them Silent Breed is people!
The journalist Annalee Newitz prefers that kind of science fiction, the dystopian futures we're supposed to avoid. Annalee, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
So why do you think dystopian sci-fi is so effective? Because it can be scary and tense and thought-provoking and therefore more entertaining and dramatic?
Well, it certainly can be more dramatic, and I think it's true that every story needs tension, it needs conflict, and so, of course, dystopia provides that for us really easily. And dystopia is a good way of saying, basically, stop doing that. What you're doing right now, say with, I don't know, surveillance, just stop, because here is a picture of where that might lead. It might lead to authoritarianism. It might lead to having no privacy at all in a way that's painful and restrictive.
I'm going to play a game with you now. I want to talk about some of the classics of dystopian science fiction film, especially, and your task is to guess the movie, and then we'll talk about why they're relevant today. So here's your first clip.
Okay.
Did you ever consider the consequences of your actions? You gave me life, and then you left me to die.
So that's a famous scene from Blade Runner. Did I get it wrong?
I'm so pleased. it's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Which version?
The Kenneth Branagh.
De
Niro.
The Kenneth Branagh.
So that was De Niro. Version. That was De Niro as Frankenstein. You could almost imagine him saying, "You looking at me? You looking at me?"
Yeah, but, and I have to just say that I think it's funny that line of dialogue could very well have been taken from Blade Runner, because I think it's a very similar kind of narrative
exactly.
set in the future.
Exactly.
So, I mean, a lot of people think of Frankenstein as the first science fiction story, and
right.
I agree, because it really was inspired by contemporary science around electricity that Mary Shelley was reading about. The other thing that it addresses, I think, that is another big theme in science fiction is what happens when technology and biology are inseparable. And this has been a dream in science fiction for a very long time, that we could treat our bodies, that we could treat life forms the same way we treat machines. So it's interesting that our technology still hasn't quite caught up to that yet. And so I think it continues to be a preoccupation of science fiction, because we still aren't in an era when we really can say that biology is as easy to tinker with as a machine.
Although we haven't quite caught up, no. But it seems as if we're getting closer and closer. And now that there are, for instance, genetically modified foods and bionic implants and all the rest, each of which gets tagged by somebody sooner or later as a Frankenstein technology.
That's right.
Is that being overused, or is that just inevitable?
Well, I think we're seeing more and more in science fiction other stories about what it would mean, for example, to have your mind liberated from your body, or to have a new body made for you. The movie Avatar, for all of its problems, gives us a very interesting picture of a future where a human who is disabled is able to put his brain into another body, which he finds pleasing and liberating. And it gives us this window on how that technology could have a good outcome in this particular circumstance.
Remain exactly where you are. Make no move until you are ordered.
Now they can see us.
Now we can see you.
I suppose we may as well say goodbye.
You may as well say goodbye. While we're on the subject, here comes a candle to light you to bed. Here comes a chopper to chop off your head.
I still don't know what it is.
That is the 1984 film version of Orwell's 1984.
Ah, excellent.
And
that's a great film version.
It is a good one, and better, for instance, than the Branagh Frankenstein. But does it still work, do you think, as it did in 1949, to talk about the world we're living in now?
1984 did come out during the rise of the Soviet Union, during the rise of using technology for regulating people in an authoritarian regime. And so as we've moved into the contemporary era, especially in the United States right now, with all of the revelations from Edward Snowden about how the NSA has been surveilling all of our emails and phone conversations, this story continues to feel deeply relevant to people.
He says the spying is worse than the book 1984.
Great Britain's George Orwell warned us of the danger of this kind of information. The types of collection in the book, microphones and video cameras, TVs that watch us, are nothing compared to what we have available today.
And yet, for all the revelations over the last couple of years, thanks to Edward Snowden, the reaction is not what one might have imagined. It was kind of a shrug and, oh, we knew they were spying on us, or I'm not doing anything wrong. Who cares? Why, having been primed for 60 years to fear this very thing by 1984, do we, most of us, not seem so terrified?
I think people are terrified, and I hear a lot. There's this idea that people are shrugging because we're not rioting in the streets, I guess. But people have changed their behavior online. People have changed their perspective on what they expect will be seen and not seen by authorities or by their company. And I think part of the reason why people maybe aren't rioting in the streets is that we have been prepared for this kind of world precisely by this science fiction and also by things that have happened historically. We've lived in an electronic surveillance state for a very long time. We've had wiretapping since the 1930s, and now it's just become incredibly mainstream. So I think people aren't shocked, but at the same time, having it confirmed outside the realm of science fiction really has changed people's understanding of what it means to go on the internet or what it means to make a phone call.
Yeah. Here is another clip that you will identify, I'm sure.
We have only bits and pieces of information, but what we know for certain is that at some point in the early 21st century, all of mankind was united in celebration. We marveled at our own magnificence as we gave birth to AI.
AI? You mean artificial intelligence?
A singular consciousness.
You gotta love The Matrix.
Absolutely, the 1999 film. And it seems as though in this century, in the last decade or so, that scary AI, beware the computers genre has kind of petered out. Is that true?
I actually don't think so. I think Terminator, interestingly, has become a franchise that's really held on in a way that Matrix didn't.
So is Google creating the next Terminator?
Google is growing its army of robots.
This is the eighth robotics company Google's bought in the last 6 months, which pretty much means we better find John Connor before the Terminators do.
We're going to have a new Terminator movie. There's going to be a new Terminator TV show coming up. And of course, in the noughties in the last decade, the Sarah Connor Chronicles was actually one of the very best science fiction shows on TV.
Right.
And it did exactly what The Matrix did, which is it took us inside the world of the AI and showed us that AI has politics too, and there's different synthetic creatures with different opinions about humanity, and that they're having their own disagreements about how to handle us the way that we do about them.
It's interesting you say that, because I think of this movie Transcendence that came out with Johnny Depp and Morgan Freeman, which sort of plays with the dystopian expectations, but in fact goes exactly where you're saying, that no, welcome the machine overlords. They are here to help us.
Well, and it's certainly something that scientists are thinking about, too. Rodney Brooks, who heads up MIT's AI lab, or has for many years, had an interesting comment about how we always think about robots and machines as being in opposition to humanity, but he really feels like the two groups are going to merge and that ultimately it'll be impossible to tell the difference between a human and a robot, because we will have filled our bodies with technologies to enhance our performance and enhance our minds. And what you're going to have is an ecosystem a lot like we have now in computers, where there are kind of crappy machines and kind of crappy software, and there's brilliant hackers who are working to make it better. There's bad guys who are working to exploit all the things about, say, Microsoft that make it vulnerable. We're going to be caught in the middle, and it'll be not just our machines, but it'll be our bodies that are caught in the middle, too. So it'll become a pretty difficult political situation.
Given that the last decade or two, certainly since the web existed, that everyday life seems more science fiction-y than it did previously in my life, does that make it harder, do you think, for writers of science fiction to do their jobs if we're kind of living in a sci-fi world already?
I think it just means that we're going to see a lot less of a boundary between science fiction as a genre and just fiction as a genre, because, as you said, people's everyday lives are so saturated with all of the objects we think of as being science fictional that now everyday experiences are actually relevant to science fiction.
Annalee Newitz, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Annalee Newitz runs the website io9. There was a lot more to our conversation, including clips of Blade Runner and Max Headroom, which she guessed correctly. You can hear our whole conversation at studio360.org. Along with robots, and ray guns, the 21st century they promised me as a kid was definitely supposed to include flying cars. We now have pretty decent robots. We've got military lasers. But the flying cars, where are they? Studio 360's Eric Malinsky went searching.
I don't know about you, but when I saw movies like Back to the Future...
Roads, where we're going, we don't need roads.
Or The Fifth Element. I never thought, wow, those flying cars look so cool. I thought, oi, those things could crash into buildings. I mean, imagine walking down the street, hearing honking, and looking up and seeing a traffic jam in the sky. Like, blech. But there is a race, a small, very well-funded race among a few aeronautics companies to make flying cars a reality. There's Terrafugia in Boston, Aeromobile in Slovakia, PAL-V in the Netherlands. They're all prototypes in various stages of development, and many of them look like mutant offspring of planes and helicopters on wheels. But there is a guy in Davis, California, who's making a flying car that looks like a red hot rod. It's called the Mueller Sky Car.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Paul Mueller was not what I expected.
Science fiction was not a big part of my life, but what I was inspired by was the hummingbird. As a kid, 5 years old, and being in a rural area of Canada, getting around was a big issue in the winter, when I actually rescued a hummingbird that had got trapped in one of my father's farm buildings, and as I let it go, to see that hover for a second and then disappear out of sight was pretty inspirational.
But there is one question he keeps getting.
How can a small company in Davis, like our company, go out there and do something that the large aerospace companies don't do?
His answer is that big companies need to turn a profit. The faster, the better. Mueller earned his money designing racing car mufflers and developing real estate. He's also kind of a mechanical genius. In high school, he built a car and a helicopter from scratch. He's been working on the Mueller Sky Car for decades, very carefully.
Failure of vertical takeoff aircraft is probably the most dangerous possible way of having something happen. There were many aircraft companies that were in the vertical takeoff market who quit because they were losing their test pilots faster than they could train them.
Now he's trying to raise almost $1 million to produce more prototypes and hire test pilots. Big donors will be allowed to sit in the back seat. He led me to an airplane hangar where he stores the prototypes.
Oh my God. There it is. Wow.
Seeing them in real life, I couldn't help but geek out.
This is a four-passenger. We call it the Skycar 400. It would require full certification, so it's probably 3 years away before it would be available on the market.
So one of the prototypes looked like a tiny red plane with four engines that look like jet engines, but they have propellers inside, and they can rotate upwards. The latest model looks like a red racing car with two engines on the side and three little ones attached to a spoiler in the back. Mueller says it can fly 300 miles per hour, although so far it's only hovered around the parking lot.
I always draw the distinction. In a helicopter, it's quite sensational, I admit, but in this helicopter, you feel like you're being lifted up from above by a crane, which is okay. But in this thing, you feel like you're being lifted up from below, which you are, of course, but it's much more what the flying carpet would give you.
For myself, I have sort of mixed feelings about it because on one hand, I hate traffic. And I really, really hate traffic, and I get huge road rage. And in fact, it took 3 hours today to get from San Francisco to here. Ooh. On the other hand, you know, as a New Yorker, we get so little blue sky as it is. You know, the thought of looking up and seeing flying cars, you know, or a row of flying cars blocking out whatever blue sky I have as it is between the skyscrapers would be upsetting to me. So I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were on that.
You're not going to see that fifth element kind of dimensions where you're going to see lots of vehicles above you. You're going to see highways in the sky that are coming. So yes, you're going to see a line of vehicles come in 500 feet apart coming into a parking lot.
Commuters will be riding autopilot 1,000 feet in the air.
It's not logical that this vehicle be down at street level and going between buildings. There's no reason for it. You're better off from an economic point of view, from a safety point of view, from everything. It'd be an electric car.
I mean, of course, we're still going to crash. But if I don't want to be a Luddite, I'll have to accept highways in the sky as normal, like telephone wires. I mean, eventually, we won't even look up when we hear a flying car. And when we're sitting in traffic 1,000 feet in the air, you know, we'll start complaining and be like, you know what someone should invent? A teleporter. That would be cool. For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
You can see pictures of Paul Moeller's sky car at studio360.org. And to close the show, as we often do, we'll hear from somebody whose life was changed by a work of art. In this case, a whole room full of art. That someone is Carl Zimmer, a respected and prolific science journalist. In the 1970s, when Zimmer was 10, his family moved to rural New Jersey, Locktown, where he didn't know anybody. He was nervous, starting a new school, but then he bumped into a nice kid named Jan.
We say hello to each other, and we just immediately hit it off and have been friends ever since.
Before long, he went over to Jan's house.
So Jan told me that his father was a full-time artist, and I found that really interesting because I didn't really know that you could do that.
Jan's dad was a science fiction illustrator, Jack Schoenherr, the science fiction illustrator at the time, the cream of the crop.
He's got photographs tacked up all over the walls. He's got the entire run of National Geographic on a bunch of bookshelves, which he would use as reference. And he's got these paintings that he's working on.
And those were the cover images for Frank Herbert's Dune, one of the most popular science fiction series ever.
I hadn't read Dune. I was more of a kind of Lord of the Rings kid. One thing that I didn't like about science fiction, the pictures that went along with it were kind of tacky. And Jack Schoenherr was making these images that were gorgeous and brooding and subtle. You know, it wasn't just showing some macho astronaut flexing his biceps or something stupid like that.
I'm John Robinson from the planet Earth.
He was really trying to make real landscape art and drawing off of a really deep understanding of our planet and of our geology, of our zoology. And it just gave me a different way of picturing the science fiction world. When you go to see a science fiction movie and, you know, the spaceship lands on a planet and the door opens up and our hero steps out and is setting foot on this new world, what they look out at often looks like a John Schoenherr painting. You know, science fiction usually involves people and aliens. And Jack Schoenherr just loved to bring real biology into his aliens. And he would paint them really carefully. I mean, he would try to paint some alien sandworm or Chewbacca-like monster as carefully as Dürer might have drawn a rabbit. He took them very seriously. And so there was a realness to them. I mean, you look at these giant sandworms from the Dune series, and you really believe those things exist. And you can't get those things out of your head once you've seen them. I think for me, that made me look at life on Earth in a different way. I started to realize that, well, actually, living things on Earth are aliens in a way. They're really bizarre when you get down to it. I mean, if you really get to know a snapping turtle or an earthworm or a tick or a bird really well, it becomes a very strange thing. And I think that that's actually had a big influence on me as a science writer. I love writing about bizarre biology here on Earth because there's no end of it. And I think I started to appreciate that sitting in his studio and looking at these things he was painting.
That's Carl Zimmer. You can see images of Jack Schoenherr's paintings at studio360.org. And while you're there, tell us about the work of science fiction that changed the way you saw the world. We may put your story on the air. But for right now, that is it for today's show. Now, I know that some of you, the sci-fi diehards, are probably ticked off about all the stuff that we did not cover. But hold the hate mail. We're coming back to this theme in just a couple of weeks. We'll hear about some MIT students who are designing versions of gadgets from old sci-fi movies and an idea about changing the Earth's climate that is literally out of a novel, and lots more. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni,
Jill Duboff,
Sophia Nguyen,
Ariel Roland Waring,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music's by David Van Tiegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, musician Andrew Bird shares the secret to his success: not thinking positively.
I do kind of, before a tour starts, imagine the worst happening, which is the bus going off a cliff.
Also, a live performance from Andrew Bird and his band next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.